ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
So you've been asked to attend your workplace diversity, equity, and inclusion workshop. Do you A, put it in your diary and label it critical importance? B, pop it in the calendar, but you'll keep your phone ready to answer urgent work emails through the whole workshop? Or C, roll your eyes and complain, I don't have time for this. In news in the US, DEI is taking some heat. What does it mean for us in Australia? Could it in fact be a good time to take stock? Hello, Lisa Leong here for This Working Life, helping to make your work life better. At the end of the show, I'll give you a work life tip to experiment with in Try This, but first, does it feel like global and national politics is really influencing our working conditions right now? Colin Ellis is a global expert in workplace culture. I spoke to him earlier and asked how things are changing when it comes to politics affecting work policy.
Politicians are making certain promises with regards to the workplace. Of course, President Trump talked about diversity and inclusion, equity and inclusion. Also, there's the hybrid working thing where you know, and this happened in New Zealand as well, we're going to get all government employees back to the office. So they've started to get really involved in the minutiae, or what we would consider to be the minutiae of the day-to-day. And that's because as an electorate, workplace culture is now more important to us than it ever has ever been before.
Given that the workplace then seems really in play when it comes to our politicians and the future of politics, what sort of power do you think workers actually have as voters, Colin?
We have the greatest power because it's on us to vote them in or out. The next generation of workforce are really going to start looking at all of these policies in greater detail and saying, okay, well, yes, it's about, of course, we want better rights, we want better pay, we want fairer, equitable payments, all of these kind of things. But also, you know, kind of what do you advocate for in the smaller elements of my working life? Because these affect me on a day-to-day basis. We spend more time with the people that we work with than we do with our family and loved ones. So we want to make sure that we've got the best conditions possible.
Colin, what would you say to leaders about the choices they can make in response to the politics playing out around them?
Yeah, don't rush to follow. We've seen this play out in the US straight away. You know, people are trying to curry favor and people are saying we're stopping all of these things. Don't rush into it. Sit with the idea, think about it, take on some sound advice. Listen to people who really understand this, you know, particularly for diversity, equity, inclusion. Please don't rush to dismiss the benefits that it brings your business. Please don't do that. Yes, you might want to look at how you embed it into the way that you work. But really, you know, I think the best business leaders, Lisa, are the ones that will kind of survey what's happening in the political landscape. And then they'll ask themselves the question, is that right for us? And is it right for us right now? If so, what can we do? And how do we give our employees agency over it such that they don't feel like it's being done to them, rather it's being done with them?
Thank you so much, Colin.
Thanks, Lisa.
That was workplace culture expert Colin Ellis. And we have a live example of politics affecting workplaces right now. It's DEI. Now, I put up a LinkedIn post about your experience of DEI, diversity, equity and inclusion, and quite a few of you had things to say. This is HR professional Sarah sharing her story.
Unpopular opinion, diversity, equity and inclusion, DEI, just annoys some people. I found this out during my time as a senior HR leader. I recall trying to persuade an executive team to approve a diversity plan. I was attempting my best to educate them on the benefits, but they were just annoyed, even irritated at the concept of diversity in general. Questions like, why do we need a diversity plan? Why do we need quotas? What is the legal requirement to do this? If there is none, then we shouldn't do it. This was a hard day for me as a HR leader. Diversity makes people who are privileged feel uncomfortable. It holds a mirror up to privilege that they simply can't turn away from. I share this story as I hope it helps others to navigate through what is set to be a tough time for DEI. I'm grateful now that I work with some amazing DEI leaders who champion the benefits of diversity. But remember, it's easy to be annoyed or place the blame on DEI. It is always harder to look in the mirror.
Thanks so much, Sarah. So let's get another expert opinion on this. Michelle Lim is an organisational culture and intersectional diversity, equity and inclusion specialist. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi, Lisa.
As someone who works in this space of DEI in Australia, Michelle, how are we going on this?
Yeah, I think, you know, right now, and we've heard from Colin and Sarah earlier, given the current, you know, climate, political climate, especially what we're seeing right now since President Trump has taken office, there is a bit of fragility around the hard-won DEI progress that has been made. And I do feel like, you know, that's something that has to be definitely accounted for here in Australia. And you know, right now that it's a time for us to assert our values as a country, but then also organisations as well. So I do feel like we're at a fragile time. It's hard to see what the changes will be and what could happen. But right now, I think it's time for us to kind of stay on high alert and assert those values.
And when you say it's a fragile time, how is that actually playing out? What are you seeing on the ground?
I think similar to what Sierra shared in her experience as a HR leader, there is, you know, a little bit of that uncomfortable reality when we're talking about DE&I or diversity, equity, inclusion, that discomfort that we see. And I think one of the things is, and it's important to take into account, that in Australia, we're a country made up of migrants. You know, according, you know, to the Australian Human Rights Commission, Australia is 29% of Australia is, our population was born overseas, and 48% of us have at least one parent who was born abroad. So we're a country of people that have come here without all of our rich diversity. And that's important to take into account when we're talking about the context specifically here in Australia, because it also means that plays a significant role in the way we talk about race and discrimination and what it means to belong. I think there is a difference here compared to the US, where there is a little bit more of a polarized approach when we talk about race. And I think, you know, race and DE&I is definitely something that is more part of the everyday literacy, whereas I feel like it's not so much here in Australia. So that's another kind of layer to take into account, is that maybe in the Australian context, there needs to be an uplift of cultural literacy, specifically when we talk about race.
Michelle Lim, in a major policy speech last week, opposition leader Peter Dutton said, I'm quoting here, Labor is hiring an extra 36,000 public servants in Canberra at a cost of $6 billion a year. Now, positions advertised have included culture, diversity and inclusion advisors, change managers and internal communication specialists. Such positions, as I say, do nothing to improve the lives of everyday Australians. From your perspective, what is this signalling?
Well, I think this is very much signalling and mirroring the rhetoric that's coming out of the US. I just want to make sure that when we're talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, that your listeners take away that DE&I is not a nice to have. It's in fact the core to workforce quality. It's core to risk management. It's core to a business's and organization's success. DE&I, in order for it to, I think, really thrive, and what we want to really see out of DE&I is equity and diversity in opinion and diversity in thinking and therefore diverse decision making. And if in order to do that, we need to embed DE&I in the way that organizations operate. And too often, you know, DE&I initiatives are seen as a nice to have reactive program rather than something that's proactive and really embedded.
You're listening to This Working Life. I'm Lisa Leong, and my guest is Michelle Lim, Organisational Culture and Intersectional Diversity, Equity and Inclusion Specialist. Would love to hear from you. What's your experience of DEI, Diversity, Equity and Inclusion programs? One here from my LinkedIn post from Unbiased Podcast. The pushback we're seeing isn't necessarily a sign that DEI has failed. It's a signal that we need to communicate its value more effectively and embed it in ways that feels authentic rather than performative. Maybe it's less about a rebrand and more about a strategic reset, focusing on inclusion as a core leadership competency rather than a standalone initiative. Lily Zhang is a workplace strategist and consultant and the author of books about diversity, equity and inclusion. DEI Deconstructed is one of them. Hello, Lily.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Well, what are your thoughts on how political DEI has become in the United States and potentially elsewhere too, Lily?
Absolutely. I think in the US, unfortunately, we have been seeing a lot of opportunistic and, in my opinion, bad faith critique of DEI that uses misinformation, that uses disinformation and falsehoods about what this work is and what it's always been trying to achieve to score political points. I think in the US and perhaps around the world, I think we are seeing a small number of, very loud people trying to manipulate popular opinion by using fear. I think when you look at the popularity of DEI, not just in the US, but around the world, it's actually quite popular. I think you might be surprised to hear that in the US, nearly 70% of people support DEI when given a definition, and over 90% of companies in the US are keeping their investment in DEI stable or even increasing it in 2025. I think given that extreme popular support, it's very surprising to me to see these kinds of political attacks that try to turn people against programs that are not only popular, but help all Americans and make workplaces stronger and healthier.
So are you saying that the level of support of DEI programs is still pretty stable then, or do you feel like it is slipping away a bit, Lily?
Yeah, so there was a recent Pew Research Center survey that did find that the support for DEI is decreasing slightly. And I think it's worrying because this is because people are being influenced by this negative rhetoric. I can absolutely note that because of this rhetoric and this misinformation, people are scared. People are worried that, you know, they might be losing opportunities, and DEI is getting a bad rap in social media, in news media, you know, by the federal government. And so, yes, I do think unless we can communicate this work and its benefit more effectively, we may continue seeing some of these worrying trends.
I spoke with Canadian workplace culture strategist Jen Moss recently, and DEI came up as part of that longer conversation. This is what she had to say.
You know, we've othered people in the effort to create belonging. A lot of the programs were like gotcha programs of just calling people out for deficits that they weren't even aware of. And so I argue that it should be about, you know, not creating groups, but creating no groups. Like it's the no group kind of DEIA strategy. And that's just really highlighting people without the demographic bias.
So Lily, are DEI programs being rolled out in a way that's making some people feel excluded?
Interesting. So you're basically asking me if there are some programs that make some members of the workplace feel excluded. I think it's not common. I think more often than not, DEI programs are simply overlooked by most people in the workplace. And the reason why I say this is because DEI, like some of the other guests that you brought on have talked about, has been historically very siloed. You often see these extremely limited programs, these very surface-level events or celebrations. There isn't really a strong case to get people involved in this work, and there isn't very well communicated what's in it for me when it comes to DEI. And so I think that reason is one of the reasons why many folks might think about DEI and think, it's not for me. It may not be actively hurting me, but it's certainly not something that I think is going to benefit me much. And so I'm just going to ignore it. I think that is the much bigger problem that we need to solve and communicate that DEI really does bring these tangible benefits, that making healthier, less discriminatory workplaces is truly better for all of us.
And Lily, you sometimes label these programs the status quo DEI programs. you've identified the things that are particularly wrong with these status quo DEI programs. Can you go into that for us?
Yeah, sure. So DEI programs that are not successful are ones that are siloed. They see DEI like a PR project, right? Just to launder their reputation, to make them look good, to make people think that they're supporting things on social media, but not actually committed to improving their workplace, to ensuring fair pay, to ensure that all of their workers are being treated respectfully, to ensuring that everyone has opportunities for advancement and promotion and fair pay. I mean, we know that these outcomes are things that not only workers from marginalized communities care about, but all workers care about. The workplaces that do a good job are able to fix their internal workplace systems to be fair, to be equitable, to be accessible, to be inclusive. And they're able to create workplaces that broadly represent everyone in society rather than just a select few. Now, unsuccessful status quo DEI workplaces are mostly just about these one and done events, right? Which are very fun and which may be enjoyable, but are very different. They're a far cry from the kinds of change management, systems change approaches to DEI that we know work and that we know create better environments for everyone.
And you're listening to This Working Life. I'm Lisa Leong, and my guest is Lily Zhang, workplace strategist and consultant, author of books including DEI Deconstructed, and also Michelle Lim, organisational culture and intersectional diversity, equity and inclusion specialist. And we've been asking you, what's your experience of DEI at your workplace? And Susanna in Marrickville has texted in to say, as a health worker, the diversity, equity and inclusion waxes and wanes. Having worked in probably the most diverse hospital in the state in New South Wales, nurse-led but without any policy or legislation, now with legislation, there are a number of responses from dismissive to token efforts. The US example will profoundly affect us as it will be weaponized to remove any progressive programs and practices for employees and customers alike. Michelle Lim, I might get your response to this from the Australian perspective.
Yeah, sure. So just like Lily mentioned about, you know, what has been working and what hasn't worked, I think from an Australian perspective, what I have at least seen that has worked is very similar to the examples that Lily shared. And that is that, you know, we need to, organisations that have really seen lasting effects of DE&I and DE&I progress is organisations, instead of framing DE&I as a moral obligation, which it is, we also focus on things like business performance. So diverse teams lead to better decision-making and innovation. We focus on things like embedding DE&I into risk mitigation, because ignoring diversity, equity, inclusion does lead, and we have seen lead, to reputational damage, legal risk, talent retention risk, which means that we don't have good decision-making, particularly if we are organisations operating in high-risk environments, similar to the example before, in a hospital with diverse communities. You need that diversity of thought and that diversity of talent. And then ensuring as well that, you know, there is that leadership capability, not just on, you know, the operational side of things, but ensuring that there's that cultural literacy as well. You know, inclusive leaders make better decisions. They create stronger, more resilient workplaces. They ensure that people feel psychologically and culturally safe. And that is essential for any organization. And I think that's what I've seen has worked in the Australian context. And I really do feel like organizations that really invest and make it part of their strategic operations, DE&I, they really do see the dividends pay forward.
Thank you, Michelle. And we've got a written note here from Marie, not their real name. My biggest worry about this reset is that neurodivergent folks from all backgrounds will not disclose their brain to their employers, and this will lead to burnout and lost opportunities. DEI shouldn't be a loaded term, but clearly change is coming. I just wish more employers were open to all neurotypes and differences in operating and processing so that employees don't have to worry about whether I tell or whether I hide. I want to go back to you, Lily Zeng, and ask you about whether we need to reset DEI. You do have an alternative framework, and there's a bit of an acronym alert. It's called FAIR. So do you want to talk us through it? Thank you, Lily.
Yes, absolutely. So yes, the FAIR framework, standing for Fairness, Access, Inclusion, and Representation, is a new framework that I've been developing in the U.S. Just because the context here perhaps demands that having alternative language as another tool for doing this work might be a little important. And I'll talk a bit more about this FAIR framework. The goal of this framework was not just to replace DEI with new language, but to take the best and most effective practices from good, effective DEI and to discard some of the things that may have done more harm than good or may have not been effective. And when I say that, what I refer to are the kinds of DEI programs that are all talk and no action, that are, you know, mostly about just, you know, communicating who's a good person or a bad person, that are about picking sides rather than bringing people together. This FAIR framework that I am talking about right now is about achieving better, meaningful outcomes, measurable outcomes for everybody. It's about building coalitions. It's about building healthier workplace systems for everyone within them that brings win-win instead of zero sum. A lot of this rhetoric that we're hearing right now is extremely zero sum. It gets people feeling scared. It gets people feeling threatened. And with this new framework, I'm hoping to really set the record straight and share that this work is not only beneficial to those who have been historically marginalized, it's actually beneficial to everyone. And we should be able to talk to people who have historically felt left out of DEI, right? Straight, heterosexual, white men without disabilities. We should be able to talk to them and say, you know what? This work is actually working to make things better for you too.
Yeah.
You need to be able to imagine a better workplace for you as well and for everyone else.
Thanks so much, Lily. Lily Zeng is a workplace strategist and consultant and author of Deconstructing DEI. And that FAIR framework is built around the core outcomes of fairness, access, inclusion and representation. And we'll put a link up to their work on our website as well. And thanks also to Michelle Lim, Organisational Culture and Intersectional Diversity, Equity and Inclusion Specialist. Next up, try this, the Pomodoro Technique. So each week we ask you to try out something new to help make your work life better. We're calling it Try This. It's an experiment we'll run together each week, and this is how it works. We're going to tell you about it, you try it, and then you report back at thisworkinglife@abc.net.au or on LinkedIn. So this week, shall we try the Pomodoro technique together? It'll help you manage your time. It's called Pomodoro because that's the Italian name for tomato, and it was named after a kitchen timer in the shape of a tomato. It was used by creator Francesco Cirillo. So I've got a really solid morning routine and I've got a really good wind down evening routine, but once I get started working, I actually forget to take breaks. Enter the Pomodoro technique. So here's how it works. Set your timer and work on a task for a focused 25-minute interval. And then you follow it with a short 5-minute break. Rinse and repeat. I actually do a longer interval, 45 minutes followed by a 15-minute break. So do what works for you and let me know how you go. And we'll put up a link there as well. And thanks for listening to This Working Life with me, Lisa Leong. It was produced by Michelle Weeks and engineered by Matthew Crawford. We're on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Nam, Melbourne. And meet me here again next Friday, live from 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Savings Time. Email me if you live in a different time zone and want to listen real time, because I've got a hack for you. And if you haven't already, search for This Working Life on the ABC Listen app and tap the heart to follow all of our stories. And we'll put up another question on LinkedIn next week for you to ponder as well. Until then, love your work.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.